You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
Welcome to the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, episode number 493.
Once you figure out who you are and what you love about yourself, I think it all kind of falls into place. Jennifer Aniston.
Broadcasting from the back alley in Hollywood, it's the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, where we show you how to survive and thrive as an indie filmmaker in the jungles of the film biz. And here's your host, Alex Ferrari.
Welcome, welcome to another episode of the Indie Film Hustle Podcast. I am your humble host, Alex Ferrari. Today's show is sponsored by Indie Film Hustle's Filmmaker Process. We provide filmmakers with professional services to get their films or series funded, finished, and distributed. Some of the services we offer are pitch deck creation, film budgets and schedules, domestic and international sales estimates, legal contract templates, consulting, post-production services, script coverage, professional trailer editing, poster design, film deliverables, and production payroll. To learn more, go to www.filmmakerprocess.com. Today's show is sponsored by Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, how to turn your independent film into a profitable business. It's harder today than ever before for independent filmmakers to make money with their films. From predatory film distributors ripping them off to huckster film aggregators who prey upon them, the odds are stacked against the indie filmmaker. The old distribution model of making money with your film is broken, and there needs to be a change. The future of independent filmmaking is the entrepreneurial filmmaker or the filmtrepreneur. In Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, I break down how to actually make money with your film projects and show you how to turn your indie film into a profitable business. With case studies examining successes and failures, this book shows you the step-by-step method to turn your passion into a profitable career. If you're making a feature film, series, or any other kind of video content, the Filmtrepreneur method will set you up for success. The book is available in paperback, ebook, and of course, audiobook. If you want to order it, just head over to www.filmbizbook.com. That's filmbizbook.com. Well, guys, today on the show, we have writer, director, and producer Charles Shire. And Charles has been behind some of the best romantic comedies of all time. He started off his career, as far as feature writing is concerned, with writing a project called Smokey and the Bandit, which was the second biggest movie of 1977, only to be beaten by a little film called Star Wars. And he's also written scripts for Jack Nicholson, a film called Going South, Private Benjamin, Protocol with Goldie Hawn, and made his directorial debut with Irreconcilable Differences with Drew Barrymore, and really exploded on the scene as a director with the films Father of the Bride 1 and 2, and also one of my favorite films of the 90s, The Parent Trap. It just goes on and on. His list of accolades are crazy. He's got amazing filmmaking stories. He was basically raised on a film set because his father was in the business, and we really go deep into not only his writing process, his directing process, how he got his projects made, but some really interesting behind-the-scenes stories on some of the greatest romantic comedies and comedies of all time. So without any further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Charles Shire. I'd like to welcome to the show Charles Shire. How are you doing, Charles?
I'm okay, man. Thanks.
Thank you so much for being on the show. I really, really appreciate it. I have been a fan of many of your films growing up. For a long time, and specifically one that I refuse to go back to watch because I have daughters now, is Father of the Bride. Because right. I have two daughters. I'm like, when am I going to actually have the courage to watch that movie again? Because I remember it so fondly. I was like, but now it's a whole other conversation.
Right. It's
It's brutal. It's a brutal conversation when you're a father, and I don't want to go there yet.
It's when you're a father of a daughter. It rings pretty true.
Yeah, exactly. And one of my daughters, it happens to be a tomboy and all that kind of stuff. So it's kind of like,
I don't. Oh, that's cool. Yeah.
So before we get started, how did you get started in the business?
Well, basically, my dad was in the movie business, so I kind of came up through the ranks a little bit. I used to go onto the set with him when I was a kid all the time, like probably from the time I was 7 years old through my teenage years, I'd go on the sets with them because in those days they worked always 6 day weeks when my dad was making movies. And so I'd go on the set, and then, you know, it was kind of a natural, you know, if he'd been in, you know, a dry cleaner, I probably would have gone into the dry cleaning business, you know, but you know, I went into the movie business and you know, I was lucky enough to get into the DGA training program. I was one of the first people to get into that. And it was kind of, you know, it was just starting out then. So it wasn't really well formed, but I did get some experience. And then I was lucky enough to become a second assistant director. And from there, I went to work for Gary Marshall and Jerry Belson. And that kind of sprung me into a whole trajectory of writing, and I was their assistant, you know.
Right.
I was Harry Marshall's assistant on a show called Hey Landlord. And basically, you know, I was like 22 years old probably, but my job was basically, you know, do their Christmas shopping, get their cars washed, you know, buy them fudge sickles and shit like that. And then for that trade-off, I got to sit in on story meetings and stuff like that, and they welcomed me to do that. And they were very, very, they're very open about all that. And you know, then, you know, once in a while I'd give them, you know, I'd pop in with my shitty idea, and they were so nice about it. They'd say, that's good, you know, keep thinking. And then Gary finally said to me, you know, why don't you try to be a writer? And he introduced me to another writer and started to, he actually became my manager, Gary. Oh, wow. Did. And he kind of guided me, you know, through, you know, a bunch of stuff. And eventually I became like the head writer on The Odd Couple. The first
right.
Year, you know, and that kind of sprung me into, you know, other stuff.
My God, The Odd Couple. Like, I mean, I used to watch that show all the time growing up. And you also worked on Happy Days. I think one episode on Happy Days you wrote.
I did a couple of Happy Days, a couple of Partridge Families. You know, I mean, I wrote a couple of Odd Couples. I wrote, like, there was a TV show called Barefoot in the Park back then. And, you know, I bounced around in TV. I didn't really like TV in those days. It wasn't like it is today. It was kind of like an orphan to movies, and I wanted to work in movies. So,
you know. Oh, I remember that. I mean, you never, if you were a film actor, you would never in a million years do a television. That would be like, oh, you're over, your career is over. So you're obviously retiring to television, where now it's the opposite.
Yeah. Yeah. It was definitely not the cool thing to do. So, you know, and people would say, oh, he's a television writer.
Oh yeah. They have to put you in the box. Yeah. There's no way you could, if you wrote Happy Days, there's no way you could write anything else but.
Right, exactly.
How did you break out of that? Because I know that a lot of writers coming up today have that same problem. I mean, Hollywood still loves to put people in boxes. I mean, you're the horror guy, you're the romantic comedy guy, you're the action guy, and you can't jump back and forth. How did you break out?
I wrote a script. We wrote a script based on a book called Cut and Run. About a young black guy who inherits, by mistake, is sent front row seats to the Lakers. He had applied for tickets and he got the wrong ones and he got front row seats. And he used those tickets. It was a really good idea, actually, to kind of manipulate his way into, you know, all kinds of things, and became like he used those tickets as his ticket. And right. Anyway, now it was a kind of a good script, and my agent sent it to Universal, somehow got wind of it and read it. And then they offered us Smokey and the Bandit for a rewrite. And, you know, it was, you know, I'm a guy from Studio City. You know, I'd never heard of an 18 wheeler or a CB radio. I mean, I didn't know what the fuck that was. That right. Shit. But, you know, it was a chance. Burt Reynolds was a big movie star then.
Oh, he was so, huge.
Huge. So we said yes, and we did it. And I didn't work on it that long, actually. I worked on it for probably 2.5 weeks. But it was day and night, you know.
Yeah.
Worked on it. And I did learn about CB radios. I did learn about 8-wheelers. I always loved country music. So And, you know, meeting with Bert was kind of cool. And
That's Bert at, like, for people that listening, you don't understand, people like Noah, Bert Reynolds and stuff like that. But for there was a 5 or 6 year period that there was no bigger movie star in the world. He was the Tom Cruise of his day, the Brad Pitt of his day. There was just nobody even close to him. And Smokey was one of those reasons. I mean, Smokey was massive hit. Massive blockbuster hit for its
It was
date.
The number two movie of the year after Star Wars. So, I mean, it was, And what's weird is, you know, I mean, I always say this, but, you know, this was my first movie credit. So they paid us, I think we got paid, I think maybe $15,000 for the two of us. So it was $7,500 each, you know, for this movie that made $300 million. The craft service guy made more money on the movie than I did. You know, I mean, it's really weird. But
welcome to Hollywood, I guess, at that point.
It's the actress. The joke about the Polish actress who comes to Hollywood and sleeps with the screenwriter. You're really treated pretty much like shit. But they were. You know, and Hal Needham, who was like the only, he was the only DGA member, I'm sure, at that time, who was packing heat. He carried a gun. He's a director with a gun in his waistband. But he was a good guy, and he was like a real shit kicker, and would say things, you know, you write it, I'll film it, and he was a courageous guy, he'd do anything. And that's why the movie, you know, they had those way out stunts that.
Yeah. So I was going to ask you how many of those stunts were in the script, or was that all kind of just worked on set?
No, we put a lot of them in. I think like that, some of those, you know, I haven't seen the movie in a long time, but the top of the car goes under.
Jackie Gleason's car. Yeah.
We came up with that. When I first saw the movie, like, you know, back in the day, I thought it was really bad. I thought, oh my God, I can't believe it. But then I guess after Bert died, they did a 40th anniversary or something of the movie. And I took my kids, one of them who's sitting with me right now, I took my kids to go see it in a movie theater. And I realized that I saw it a whole different way. It really works. You know, Jackie Gleason was great. Jerry Reed was great.
Sally
and Bert had a great chemistry. The music was great. And Hal did a good job. But Gleason was just fucking hysterical. He was just brilliant. So, it worked. The movie worked.
So after that, obviously your name is now, you're a writer on a big, big Hollywood hit. So then you collaborate with Jack Nicholson on a directing project, and he's an actor in it. What was it like collaborating with him on that level? Not just as a, because you were a writer on that project, but how is Jack Nicholson as a director?
I think Jack in those days was off balance about comedy. You know, I mean, I remember seeing we went down to Durango, Mexico. Mm-hmm. And that's where we were shooting. And so I would, during the day, my partner and I would go to Jack's house, because he had housekeepers and all that shit. And we would write there because it was so much nicer than wherever we were living, you know? But he studied comedy. He was very open, you know, to suggestions and stuff. At that time, and maybe always, he's like the coolest guy you've ever met. I mean, he just is. I mean, just, you know, with his shades and smoking dope and being cool and
is that before? This is post Easy Rider, right?
Yes, post Easy Rider.
Okay,
but he was a huge movie star, and he was about to go do
to the Shining.
So he talked to Stanley Kubrick on the phone. I remember him, you know, he'd call him Stan the Man.
Yeah.
And, you know, he had nicknames for everybody. But it was fun. And the thing about Jack is that I think the challenge was, in many ways, he could keep going even when we were shooting till 2-3 in the morning pitching and stuff, you know. And, you know, we were younger than him, and but it was very hard to drop Jack. You know, we would start to fade, you know, your eyes start to roll back in your head at a certain point, and he'd keep going. No, no, come on, let's keep going, let's keep going. And so you couldn't, he just had energy that I couldn't even imagine having. But he was a cool guy and a good guy. I really liked him a lot.
And then I remember a movie that you wrote that I remember was almost became part of the zeitgeist at the time was Private Benjamin.
Right.
When that came out, it was 80, I think. It was 1980.
Right.
And I was very young at the time, but I remember seeing it. I remember my parents talking about it. And I just remember it being – was it the first time there was a comedy placed in boot camp? Or was it just the twist of a woman with Goldie Hawn?
I think it was the twist of a woman. I think there was like Dean Martin and Jerry Lewis.
Yeah, Gomer Pyle, obviously. Yeah.
Did a service comedy. But, you know, and Stripes came out after us. But, yeah, I think it was the twist was this Jewish American princess who ended up in the army. That was the twist. And Goldie was perfect for that part, you know. I mean, she just really knew how to play it. And, you know, her mom was Jewish, so she got it. You know, and writing it with Nancy, who was a Jewish girl from Philadelphia, it just all came together for us.
Now, how do you approach working? Because, you know, you've written a lot of stuff with Nancy. How do you approach having a writing partner as opposed to writing by yourself?
Well, you know, you... For me and Nancy, and for everybody I've written with, I've written with Nancy. I wrote with Alan Mandel, and I wrote with Elaine Pope, and I just wrote a couple of scripts with my friend Rebecca Connor. What you have to have is the same sensibility, and that's tricky, because Nancy and I just we just laughed at the same things. We loved the same movies. We kind of educated each other on the movies that each of us loved, and Nancy really made me laugh. I think she wrote the best one-liners of anybody I know except Neil Simon. I mean, she was up there with really writing great lines. And we were just always in sync. We as filmmakers had this thing that if we're doing something and one of us doesn't – like if we were doing a scene and one of us didn't agree with it, we would always try it another way. Mm-hmm. We would never say – nobody dictated what we're going to do. We'll find a compromise. Or if one of us doesn't like it, we'll find another way to do it, you know. And that was kind of – it was kind of almost unspoken. We just were in sync. Nancy and I were very much in sync when we were making our movies. So we hardly ever disagreed. And she really made me laugh.
Now, when you were working on with a fresh-faced Whoopi Goldberg on Jumping Jack Flash. That wasn't your first. Was that your first directorial feature?
I didn't direct it. Penny Marshall did.
That's right. So which was your first directorial?
My first directorial was Irreconcilable Differences.
That's right, yes, with Drew and Shelley Long. What was it like jumping onto that set, like, as a director? Because you've been around so many, obviously, directors.
That was the thing, Alex, that for me – being on a set was really, I knew, you know, when I was 10 years old, I knew what a key grip did. You know, I mean, I knew it all, you know, so I was never, that was one of the things people used to say, you're nervous about directing your first movie. I really wasn't that nervous because I knew the milieu so well. I just was so comfortable on a set. I grew up on movie sets. So, And Nance and I had written the script, so that's the other thing. When you've written the script, you're not – the actors can't ask you a question that you don't know the answer to, you know.
Right.
I mean, and as for me, that was very, very emboldening. And also, Ryan O'Neill was fantastic to work with. Whatever his reputation was in the world, he was just totally great and totally there for us. And Shelley was brilliant, and Sharon Stone, who we discovered in that movie, it was all
right.
It was very harmonious, and we just all really got along, and it was a really cool experience. And we saw the movie. American Cinematheque did a screening about a year ago, and Nance and I went. We were both kind of nervous about seeing it again, but I thought it really held up, and it was pretty inventive, and I liked it. I thought it was a cool movie.
Now, when you're on set, I mean, every once in a while, I know all directors have to deal with this at one point or another, where you have the, especially when you're the young director, the first time director, you'll have the seasoned DP or the seasoned production designer or seasoned script soup, you know, scripty, who starts, you know, busting your chops a bit or, you know, starts testing you. How do you approach that? I'm assuming you've had that happen to in your life at one point or another on set.
Well, you know what it is? It's for me, when I realized that that was going to happen, what I never wanted to do was what I realized after the first time I blocked a scene, you know, you have these guys with the turquoise belts standing there watching you saying he doesn't know what he's doing, you know? And I said, I'm not doing this shit. So I realized early on, clear the set, just me, the DP, the script supervisor, and the first assistant director, and the actors, and Nancy, if Nancy was there. And I block it that way so nobody's watching. I don't have to worry about it, you know, and the actors, then we bring everybody in. So, and on Irreconcilable, Billy Fraker was the DP, who, right, you know, he was kind of a brilliant, yes, and a great guy, you know, and was there for us and had worked, you know, with Warren Beatty when he first directed Heaven Can Wait. So he was very good with first time directors, and he was just so kind to us and just really knew what he was doing. He was a cool guy. So that helped a lot. And he really did a beautiful job, you know.
But so that's how you handled it. So you cleared the set, did everything, yeah, and then brought everybody in.
Yeah, because guys are shaking. You look over and they're shaking their head. Like, yeah, like you could fucking do it better, dude. Come on. But
it's always that way. I mean, I was, you know, I'm assuming, I don't know if it happens to Steven Spielberg, but I'm assuming somebody out there is going, I could have done that better. Like,
right. He doesn't know what he's doing. And and you know what? I don't. Right. No, you're right. Right. I don't know what I'm doing. I'm trying to figure it out, you know. But you know what it is? It's like if you're writing a script and somebody's looking over your shoulder while you're writing, you go, what the fuck? You know, you can't, you know, like, give me a break. I mean, that's why Martin Scorsese has a rear view mirror, you know, on his monitor when he's shooting, so he can see if people come up behind him.
Oh, well, I didn't know that. Really? Oh,
yeah. I always make the producers have their own monitor. So I'll be there sitting with the script supervisor, and my favorite DP operates himself, so he can come over and look at the playback if he wants. But I don't ever have anybody around me. I mean, I'll have my son or my daughter or something like that, but yeah, nobody who's gonna shake their head.
Do you ever let the actor watch?
Yeah, sure I would. You know, this last movie I did, I was so lucky because it was a very difficult shoot, but I had the nicest actors ever that I've ever worked with. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, Justin Hartley was as nice as anybody and cooperative as anybody I've ever worked with. So that was really cool. That helped me through it.
Now, how do you balance confidence on set with when you are just like, hey man, I just don't know what we're going to do here. Let's figure it out. Cause it takes a strong director who's very comfortable in their own skin to just say out loud, guys, I really don't know what we're going to do here. I'm open to ideas. Let's figure this out together. That doesn't happen often, especially early on in your career, unless you're very comfortable with yourself. How do you approach that confidence and also just confidence of not knowing what, because we all don't know the answers at all times as a director.
Well, I storyboard. I'm not cocky enough to just go in and wing it. So I storyboard everything. Right. You know, I storyboard everything. And if I don't storyboard it, I map it, you know, so I know where. In other words, if I have a dinner scene, I'll know before the actors get there where everybody's seated, you know, I'll diagram it and stuff. So I think you have to instill in the actors confidence in you, you know, and luckily what I didn't realize, like on this last movie I did, I've done so many movies now that they assume a certain that I know more than I know. But so I, you know, which is kind of comfort, which is nice, actually, because it kind of will just follow whatever you want to do. And, you know, certain times I say, I'll change things in the middle. This isn't working. And, you know, I think if you're honest, you know, they'll understand unless they're jerks. And I guess, you know, I've worked with some actors who have really been really not nice. And it makes you uptight. You know, you don't want to freeze up. But I don't know. It's a challenge.
It's a challenge to say the least. But I have to ask you, I was asking you earlier, when you worked with Whoopi on Jumpin' Jack Flash, did you work with Whoopi at all? Writing that or anything?
We rewrote the script. And when we got the script, it was actually a drama.
Oh, God.
You know,
it's a little different.
Comedy. And then for some reason, I don't know, Nance and I were kind of arrogant in those days. We didn't want to put our name. Our names aren't on. Didn't we use pseudo names?
You did use pseudo names, yeah. But now it's on your IMDb. But you did use a pseudo name.
Yeah, we used pseudo names, which was so ridiculous. but you know, I don't even know why. I know that the first director who did it was Howard Zeef was on it, mm-hmm. who had directed Private Benjamin and directed another movie I did called House Calls with mm-hmm. Walter Matthau and Glenda Jackson, but Howard and Whoopi somehow didn't get on, and Howard got fired. And then Penny Marshall came on and did it. And I don't, to be honest with you, I don't think I've ever seen the movie.
Fair enough.
I don't think I have. If I have, I have no recollection of it. But I know... Whoopi I've talked to her a few times about it, and she was very sweet about we did a really good rewrite on the script. We did make it funny. I just don't know if it was a very good movie because I never saw it.
So. Right. But it did okay at the box office. Did okay. And she ended up doing all right in her career. Mm-hmm. Not too bad. Now, what is your approach with directing actors? How do you pull those performances out, especially comedy, which is so difficult? I mean, obviously casting is a very big part of that, but how do you kind of, you know, corral or pull those performances out?
Casting's kind of, it can't be overstated how important casting is, but you know, it's different with every actor. Like with Steve Martin and Diane Keaton, Nancy and I would actually, and they liked this, Nancy and I would actually go into the set and work out the scene ourselves, and then we would act it out for them, literally. You know,
so it's a step away from a line reading.
it's a step closer than a line reading.
Exactly.
We would act it out. I would do the blocking. I remember we did it several times, and Diane and Steve loved it. They loved that. Oh, great. Okay, I know exactly that. Well, you know, and then they'd make it 1,000 times better.
Of course.
But so we would do that a lot. And then, I will give line readings, or I'll keep going till I know I have something that I can use. You know, it's not like Broadway. You're not coming back tomorrow night. You better get it now. Now, oftentimes I'll think, oh, I can loop this reading or this intuition, you know, this the way they're saying something. But, you know, it's, you know, when somebody's not funny or they don't have rhythm, you're kind of up against it, man. You know, you've miscast.
Yeah. And I think and people listening, comedy is all about timing. It's all about the beats, and it's literally fractions of a second that something's funny and something's not.
It's frames.
It really comes down to that. I mean, I've been an editor for most of my career, and I've got comedies, and I've cut with some very accomplished comedians who were like, nope, that beat's off on the beat. And it's all about that timing. I'm assuming you, because you've done so many comedies in your career, you can kind of sense those beats on set when you're directing.
Yeah, right? It's a weird thing because I don't believe that it's something you can learn. You know, my dad was funny, mm-hmm. And I think you kind of inherit it. You know, our daughter Hallie, Nancy, and my, you know, is a accomplished now writer director. Mm-hmm. But you know, I mean, you grow up with a certain kind of humor in your. I don't know, maybe not everybody, but for me that was real helpful. And then I always loved comedies, like, you know, I liked comedies and I liked westerns. I, you know, liked movies that took place in outer space. I wasn't interested in, you know, I just didn't dig them at all, you know, and still don't. But Billy Wilder movies, I always thought, or Preston Sturges, or Howard Hawks, you know, or those guys. I mean, those are the movies I really loved, you know, or you know, like a 20th century.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
You know, like Carol Lombard. I mean, you know, but that was the thing, though. Back in those days, they had actresses like Carol Lombard, Barbara Stanwyck, Irene Dunne, people who could just knock it out of the park, these women, but you don't really have them anymore like that. I don't know why, you know.
It's not. Yeah, I know exactly what you mean.
You didn't have to give them line readings, dude.
Really? You know, yeah. They were just masters. It's like It's like walking on a Hitchcock set in his prime. Yeah, yeah. He's just like, you know, he doesn't even look. What are the rumors? He never looked at the camera.
It was like
He's just like, just give me my storyboards and let's move on.
I was looking at the leading ladies, though, a lot, apparently. You know?
That's what the rumors were. Now, when you write, do you begin with plot or with character?
I would say plot, definitely.
Really?
Well, yeah, I this new movie that I wrote is kind of autobiographical. So I started with the character, but the plot was about my life. So it was kind of intermixed. But I would say more than not, like the hook of the movie I would think more plot, but characters right intertwine with that. You know, it's hard to separate them, you know?
Well, of course you need both, but I always love to know what's the genesis of the ideas. Like I have this idea for this caper and then I'm going to create characters in it. Or I'm like, I've got Indiana Jones and I could create an adventure for him.
Right. See, for me, it would be more. I the caper would come first, I think, for me. Like with with Benjamin, it was more, the situation: a Jewish girl joins the army. I have that. Then I can go from there. Or Irreconcilable, a kid, you know, wants to separate from its parent. Her parents. All right. Well, who are they? You know, then you start going, or who is she? Who is the Jewish American princess? You know, or that kind of thing, basically.
Now, how did you get involved with Father of the Bride and trying to remake a classic?
Yeah, Steve Martin contacted us. I mean, he had three people he liked. He had seen Baby Boom and really liked it. Mm-hmm. And there was a script already written that he didn't love. And I remember, so we loved Steve so much. And it was like an honor. And he was in New York. So Nance and I had never seen the original Father of the Bride. I didn't even know it existed. You know, it wouldn't be my kind of movie necessarily. But I remember, so we said, yes, let's go meet him. God, fuck, are you kidding me? So we got on the airplane. And I hadn't read the script yet, right? You know, because I just knew I wanted to.
That's Steve.
I read the script and I wanted to jump out of the airplane.
Was it that you just were not a fan?
I thought, Jesus, man, this is awful. But we went in and met with him. And I think he had three different people. He was me and Nance and two other people. And we met with him and he said, yeah, let's make it. And that was cool. And then we went back and we kind of watched the movie. We watched the movie the night before we met with him in the hotel or something. Maybe Nancy had already seen it. I don't know. I hadn't. Mm-hmm. And then we just went ahead and what's good about a movie like that is when somebody is so clearly identifiable in their, the way they act and everything, it's easier to write for him, you know. Right. So we wrote it for Steve, knowing what Steve could do, and then you know we had made Baby Boom with Diane, so we we had to shoehorn into her into the script. Nobody wanted her.
Really?
Yeah, nobody.
Why?
Because they said that she was the kiss of death. She had made movies that had bombed after, and Baby Boom was not a hit. And they kept pushing. You can't believe the kind of actresses, you know. We fought for her, and finally they gave in. But
you would think like it's Diane Keaton, for God's sakes, like, you know,
dude, please. Annie Hall, come on.
I mean, come on.
I know.
Godfather, crazy? I mean, come on. It's, you know. Yeah,
no, but you have no idea. Well, a lot of times in movies, and maybe in any job, your boss is dumber than you. You know,
shocking, right? I know it's shocking. Shocking.
Yeah. No, but yeah, you know what I mean.
And of course,
how did they get to be my boss? Because I, you know, and they're the, and for most of the times they're the people who hated me in high school. So, you know,
right? Exactly. Telling,
you know, so, you know, it's hard. You have to, and you have to have that technique of when they give you an idea, you have to say, that's a good idea, but how about we do this instead based on your idea, which is not based on their idea at all. It's but just massaging them. Yeah. You know, it's like Mike Nichols said, you know, executives thinking having a note is a creative, you know, thing. And it's not really, I mean, anybody can have notes, but, yeah, it's hard. It's, you know, you got to play the game.
But you got her. So you obviously got Diane in. But like, so we're working with someone like Steve, who at that time, I think he was at the height of his powers as well. He was a huge star at the time.
Yeah.
You know, how much was he riffing on set? Because, I mean, he's
a very, very polite person. So he would always say to us, when you have what you want, when you have it the way you want it, like we're shooting a scene, when you have it the way you want it, tell me because I have an idea. You know, and then he would do his idea, which was invariably better than anything we had. And every time it was his idea, it's in the movie.
Oh, really?
It was funny. But he never would say, he always wanted us to get what we wanted first. And then he would do it, which is smart. Kind of brilliant.
You know, it's a smart way of approaching it. Because like him or Robin Williams or someone like that, that just are just spewing genius constantly.
Yeah.
And then you're like, I've spoken to many people who've worked with Robin. I'm like, how did you handle Robin on set? And like, you don't, you just get him, you get what you want once, and then you just let him loose. Because it's just, and again, most of the time what Robin
it's
gave
gold.
Him.
It's gold. Yeah. Because they're better than you. You know, I mean,
you know, you
deal with it, you know,
you're working with geniuses. I mean,
yeah.
Steve is that guy.
Yeah. And he was also really sweet about everything. So, I mean, it was really kind of, he fit that role, fit him like a glove too.
Oh,
you know,
it's remarkable. And then Kimberly, the daughter, the story was that she came in as a friend of somebody who was auditioning and then.
No, that's not really true. But I, you know, she was going to Northwestern at the time and she was like, I don't know if she'd even done anything.
She had done nothing, she said.
Nothing, no. But and a lot of women who became stars, you know, Gwyneth Paltrow, Scarlett Johansson, a lot of people auditioned for that role, but none of them seemed exactly right. And then Kim came in, and I don't know, she just rang the bell for us. It was like Lindsay in Parent Trap. She just felt right. She was innocent, and we kind of wanted an unknown, and I don't know. She rang the bell for us. That's what Lubitsch used to say.
It's just like there's a thing that you can't quantify when the right actress or actor walks in. It's nothing that you can explain. You're just like, well, that's just it. And then I'm assuming when they got together with Steve, and Steve was like, well, this is.
Yeah, we screen tested her. I know with Steve, maybe with Diane too. I think with Steve for sure. And yeah, it was just, she was right. But you're right. When you have that feeling, just go with it.
Listen to the gut. Oh my God. Is that like the best advice you can give somebody right now? It's just like, listen to your gut. Cause I've not listened to my gut so many times in my career. And it's always screwed me.
You know, Alex, Nancy and I used to have a thing on our monitor that actually said gut, G-U-T. It's good, just so we'd remember, because you're absolutely right. That instinct you have to go with.
Yeah, because if you let this get in the way, if you let your brain get in the way, you're done.
You'll improve it into a failure, as Billy Fraker used to say. Yeah, but that's exactly what happens, yeah.
Now, after Father of the Bride, Father of the Bride was a monster hit.
Yeah.
Very big hit. You've already done a few hits already, but Father of the Bride, was that one of the biggest of your career at that point?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, you know, we got nominated for an Oscar. We won the Writers Guild Award for Private Benjamin and got nominated for an Oscar. So that was a pretty big hit and a pretty big success for us. But yeah, I guess I don't know.
I know it was a pretty big deal when it came out. Did doors open a little bit faster for you after that?
Well, actually, you know, for me and Nancy, I don't think we ever wrote a script we didn't sell. You know, just honestly, I mean, we were riding high. We could kind of do what we wanted back then.
Right. It was in the height of your powers at that point.
Yeah, and it was the height of time where they made movies for, you know, not like today where
$20 million, $25 million.
Yeah, right? Yeah. It's really a battle, you know.
Now you got to go with streamers. Streamers are making those kind of $25 million, $20 million movies.
Yeah, I mean, and I luckily got in with Netflix, and I've loved working with them. Creatively, financially, it ain't the best situation, but creatively, they've been pretty fantastic.
Yeah, you know? I hear they just let you go once it's
they let you go. I mean, I don't. You know, they hardly give us any notes on the scripts. I mean, maybe that's because the scripts are good and stuff. But and they're not jerky about it. They don't dictate. You know, I'll give you a little. When we were doing Father of the Bride, Jeffrey Katzenberg, we had these preview and we got these numbers like Lion King numbers. You know,
yeah, right.
I mean, they were like huge, but. And Katzenberg said to us, you know, look, I have some notes. I'm going to give you these notes, but all I'm asking is that you read the notes and you try them. You don't have to ever show me. And if they work, fine. If they don't worry about it. And it was so freeing that, and we did try some, we tried them all. And if they worked, we kept them in. If they didn't, you know, we did, and we never heard from them again. And that was it. And that was such a cool thing. And that's kind of the way Netflix is. They say to you, you know, we have an idea. Try it. Tell me what you think. If you guys disagree, tell us. So, I mean, they're very open about that creatively. So that's great. And that's almost almost, but not quite a even trade off for not getting paid money.
So, but please let everybody know that that's generally not the way it works in Hollywood, that you generally don't have freedom and have creative.
No, you don't.
You know, how did you deal, like coming up, like what was like the worst scenario on and you could tell the name of the film or not, that you just had to like fight tooth and nail for your vision?
Well, I remember once the head of Warner Brothers called me and Nancy into a meeting and had notes on Private Benjamin. And we looked at, and he had this fucking script. With like, you know how you turn down the pages?
Oh, dog-eared it, yeah.
Yeah. There must have been 50 turndowns on his script, you know? And by the time he got to the fourth turndown, Nance and I were so prepared, and Nancy especially was so tough that he closed the script and said, I can't do this. And he stopped giving us notes.
Really? But what did you guys do? So what did you guys do to stop
him? We just said, well, if you do this, you know, a lot of times it's like a domino thing. They have an idea and it affects, you know, the third act or something. You know, they just don't think shit out. So, and they were also idiotic ideas, you know, a lot of them. You know?
Shocking.
I remember when Kim met her boyfriend in the movie, they were watching, His Girl Friday or one of these movies, one of these Hawks movies. And they wanted us to make it a more contemporary movie. You know, it's all this shit that you go,
who cares?
Shut up. Yeah, who cares? It's like, But they want to put their imprint on the movie mm-hmm. in some way. So I guess they can tell their wives or girlfriends or boyfriends.
That was my idea.
Yeah. Exactly right.
That was my idea. Oh, you see the Howard? They were going to make a Howard Hawks movie there, but I put in E.T.
Yeah.
You see?
Yeah.
Something like that.
I mean, yeah. I made him use James Cameron, you know, which is funnier, you know? I don't know. It's, you know, look, you just deal with it. But you can't let him break your heart, and you can't. And you gotta roll with it, dude. Or you're, mm-hmm. you know, they'll, you know,
don't get in this
especially
business.
In this culture, it's so toxic. You fuck up, you can be gone forever, and we see that all the time with people. So mm-hmm.
it's not like, I mean, oh God, imagine the things that were said or done in the '80s, seventies, or eighties. No. I mean, Jesus Christ, how could?
No, and the way the directors like Otto Preminger, George Stevens, and guys like that who would scream at the crew.
Oh you know, my God, legendary.
You know, You can't do that anymore, man. You know, they'll Joe go to HR and you'll be, you know.
Joe Pitka.
I had a problem on my last movie with a production designer and you know, because it just wasn't happening. And I got pissed off, you know.
They were screaming? They were screamers?
Yeah. And Netflix got really upset about it because the production designer quit. But I was glad he quit because he was no good.
Right.
That's one of the problems. When you make a lower budget movie, you often get lower
quality.
Caliber.
Yeah. Caliber. Yes. Yeah. Lower caliber like people.
And friends, you know, and you know, I mean, people who make good money make it for a reason.
There's a reason why Ron Howard waits for his first AD.
That's right.
There's a reason. He's like, I can't shoot until I have him.
Like the first AD I just worked with, I don't know that my movie would have turned out. I know it wouldn't have turned out as well without him or with my friend who's a DP. You know, I fought for certain people and, you know, they help make the movie with you. You're not alone. No?
One thing I want people to be, and I've said this 1,000 times on the show, I want people to be very clear about this. No matter who you are, no matter how, what age you're at, what level of the business you're at, you still got to fight. Everyone's got to fight.
Oh,
you're going to get punched in the face constantly because there's an illusion. There's like this kind of myth out there. It's like, oh, well, you've been nominated for an Oscar. You won an Oscar and you've made hundreds of millions of dollars. Like they just roll up and just throw money at your feet and you could do whatever you want. That's not the reality of the business.
No. Also, you're fighting nature. You're fighting all these kind of, things where the actor doesn't get it right. You know, I can't tell you how many times I would bury my head in my, you know, I hate this fucking movie, you know, you go, I can't do this. This is flipping me out, you know, or you wake up in the middle, you know, the other thing is that you realize it's Billy Wilder said this every day after you rap on the drive home, you realize how you should have shot the scene. You just shot, you know,
isn't it Marty who says, if you don't look at your movie at one point and go, this is absolute crap, you're not doing it right.
Right. Yeah. No, I mean, the first time we looked at Private Benjamin, we thought career ender. We'll never work again.
Let's go make cookies.
At assembly, you know, and same with Baby Boom. We thought this is it. We'll never work again. and we didn't blame them for never hiring us again.
Right.
It takes so much work to get it right. And then a lot of times you can't get it right because it doesn't work. That's the movie part.
Right, exactly. And I just want to talk about Parent Trap because honestly, it is one of my favorite. Like my family and I love it. I introduced my daughters to it. How did you approach doing that classic? Because that was a beloved classic.
Well, that was more Nancy's idea than mine because Nancy had loved the Parent Trap, the Haley Mills version.
Yeah,
you
know? Yeah.
And we were at Disney anyway at the time. And so we went to Jeffrey Katzenberg and said, we want to remake it. And that came kind of naturally. That was again, this was more Nancy than me because I didn't really, I loved Haley Mills and I thought the original movie was really good. And I liked Brian Keith. But I don't know, it was kind of not an easy rewrite, but it was something that came very naturally to us. And then when we got Lindsay, that was striking gold, really.
Yeah, she was amazing.
She was amazing. I mean, she was 11 years old and just could act her ass off. I mean, she was just great. And it launched her, obviously. And Natasha was great. You know,
oh,
Natasha,
God. And Dennis. Yeah. And Dennis.
Yeah. Great. Sought us out, actually. She wanted the part. We didn't really even know her work that well, but she was so, so perfect for the role. I mean, we got very lucky. All the casting on that movie really worked out.
Yeah. And I mean, after watching that movie when I was younger, I was like, I got to go to Napa. I mean, that's just gorgeous.
Yeah. 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 We shot a lot of that on the Coppola estate.
Oh, you know? Okay. Yeah, I've been to that estate. Yeah, it's beautiful. Yeah. Oh, such a stunning estate.
Yeah. Yeah, it was great. And also, hey, you know, because Dean Tavalaris did the production design on that movie. Mm-hmm. He did all Coppola's movies, you know. So he got us in with Francis. So we spent time with Francis. And that was just all pretty great.
That must be pretty cool hanging out with Francis. Yeah.
And having Dean Tavalaris do your movie is pretty incredible, too. He's like a genius.
That's
like Cameron Mendes, one of these. He's maybe the best production designer, one of the top three or four of all time.
That's amazing. And I'm going to ask you a few questions I ask all of my guests. What advice would you give a filmmaker trying to break into the business today?
Jesus, man, I don't know. I mean, my son who's sitting here with me wants to do it. And I think number one, if you would... Do you want to be a filmmaker? I don't know what that means. Do you want to be a writer or a writer director? I think to be a director, it really helps to be able to write your own movie, because if you don't, you're going to have to make films that knock people out that let you direct. But if you write a script, you can kind of handcuff yourself to the script if it's good enough, you know, and say that's what we did with. With Irreconcilable. We said we're not gonna go with another director, But I think it's really hard today. I guess maybe with streaming and stuff, you come up with a really strong idea. But if you write it yourself, I know you increase your odds tremendously.
Now, what is the lesson that took you the longest to learn, whether in the film industry or in life?
I think it took me a long time to realize I'm better than I think.
You mean imposter syndrome, getting over imposter syndrome?
Yeah, exactly right. You know, I mean, on this last movie, I started to really feel, a sense of accomplishment for what I've done. You know, like one of the weird things that happened on this movie, this crew, the thing that they were most impressed that I'd ever done was Smokey and the Bandit, and you know, and
that's
and,
pretty. It is a pretty cool credit, I have to say.
I was my head was spinning. I'm going, what are you talking about? Why would that be? Mean, you know, no, you don't understand. It changed my life, and you know, like Justin Hartley has that the car that Burt Reynolds drove in the movie. I mean, you know, these. You know, I'm going, well, geez, all right, but starting to appreciate. What I've done was something that took me a long time to really embrace.
And three of your favorite films of all time?
I would say Oh Lucky Man, Lindsay Anderson movie. Do you know that movie?
I don't know that movie.
Oh,
you know. I have to see that movie.
It with Malcolm McDowell.
Man.
That I would say All About Eve.
Mm-hmm. Great movie.
Yeah. Probably... I have more. The Apartment, 20th Century, and I think Back to the Future is one of the best screenplays ever.
It's as perfect of a film as ever been made, honestly.
Yeah. It's like The Apartment is a perfect movie.
Correct. Perfect, you know? Yeah, and that's been mentioned many times in the top three here at the show of The Apartment.
And then All About Eve, the dialogue is like, forget it, who writes like this? You know? I mean, who writes? You know, you're too short for that gesture. I mean, who writes lines like that, you know?
That's really awesome. And what's your next project that's going to be coming out?
Well, I'm editing this movie now that will be out. It's actually not coming out till Christmas of 2022. But because we don't finish until February. But then I'm going to try to do this autobiographical movie that I've written that I have a sneaking suspicion that I'll probably do it with Netflix again. So I'm going to do that because I like working there. If I can only get them to up the salary a little bit, I'll be fine.
Hopefully they'll watch this and maybe they'll take a hint.
Yeah, that would be good. Yeah. No, it's a nice place to work, though, I have to say.
Charles, it has been an absolute pleasure talking to you, man. Oh, it is. Cool. Thank you so much for having being on the show and doing just bringing so much joy and happiness to people around the world for all the years that you've been doing this, man.
Oh, you're too kind. Will you let me know when it's going to be on?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I'll send you a link when it's all ready. It'll be on in a few weeks. But thank you again so much for being on the show, my friend.
All right. It's a pleasure. Thanks, man.
I want to thank Charles so much for coming on the show and dropping his knowledge bombs on the tribe today. Thank you so much, Charles. If you want to get links to anything we spoke about in this episode, head over to the show notes at indiefilmhustle.com/492. And if you haven't already, please head over to filmmakingpodcast.com, subscribe, and leave a good review for the show. It really helps us out a lot. Thank you so much for listening, guys. As always, keep that hustle going. Keep that dream alive. Stay safe out there, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Indie Film Hustle Podcast at IndieFilmHustle.com. That's IndieFilmHustle.com.